Greetings, preppers, survivalists, free thinkers, and freedom fighters. It is 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Eastern Standard Time, on Monday, January 31st, 2011. And you know what that means, people? That's right. It means you have found yourselves on the front lines in this global war on humanity. And I am your humble host, majority of the time, and fearless leader for the next 90 minutes, possibly longer. And we are broadcasting to you live from a desolate outpost somewhere on the outskirts of FEMA Region 1. That's right, we have not changed locations yet. We're not on the run yet. Possibly in the near future, but not yet. Then we'll have to come up with some type of mobile command center, constantly changing our location to avoid prosecution. All right, tonight's call-in number is 917-889-3064. I will repeat that frequently throughout the program tonight. 917-889-3064. Big show tonight. Big show. We have a guest coming on that we've had on the program, I think, two times prior. But it's about time we got ourselves a Planet X update. So I have my special guest, Mr. John DiNardo, showing up on the program about 30 minutes past the hour. I have scheduled the show for a little longer this evening in case we really get rolling. If conversation dies, we'll just end it at 7:30 as normal. But if we're, you know, up to our eyeballs in Planet X, we will continue on until 8 o'clock for those hardcore listeners that want to make it through. Before we go there, though, well, I figured, let me just explain myself. I figured it was about time to get a Planet X update. I think the last time John was on the program was, I want to say August, possibly September, not quite sure, somewhere in there. But there's been so many Earth events since then, everything from earthquakes, volcanoes, to massive cold fronts, mass animal die-offs. I figured we would get a Planet X researcher on here to see what the relationship is, if there is any. And I think we all know what the outcome will be for tonight's program, where the mindset will be. But I have a bunch of questions set up for John, and we have spoken a couple times over the past few days, so it should be interesting. He has a lot of new information. So one more thing before we get to my guest, John DiNardo, and into our Planet X journey this evening. I wanted to give you an update on Chile. If you guys remember back in February, Chile was the victim of an 8.8 earthquake, massive earthquake, that actually shortened our day by a few, I don't know, a hundredths of a second, tenths of a second. And that is out of the mouth of Michio Kaku, who's told us that. So that's how powerful earthquakes can be. It actually shortened our day. So let's see here. Central Chile still runs the risk of a large earthquake close to the site of last February's magnitude 8.8 event, scientists say. It was widely speculated at the time that the tremor would have released pressure on the fault running through the country's Maule region, but a new study finds the strain has not been released markedly and has, in fact, increased in places. The Nature Geoscience report should aid preparedness, researchers say. Maule's 8.8 event occurred at the converging boundary between the Nazca and the South American tectonic plates. These vast slabs of the Earth's surface are grinding past each other at a rate of centimeters per year. The quake's epicenter was about 100 kilometers from Concepcion City, just off the shore, and at a depth of about 35 kilometers. It caused widespread damage to buildings and other infrastructure. The tremor also set off tsunamis that inundated the coastline. More than 500 people are known to have been killed. The quake occurred in what scientists referred to at the time as a seismic gap, a zone along the tectonic plate interface that had not experienced a major quake since the one witnessed by Charles Darwin in 1835 during his famous Beagle expedition. The assumption had been, therefore, that Maule's 8.8 quake would have released the strain that it had built up in the rocks over 75 years. And the article goes on to say that that strain has not been released. It has been increasing. So basically, we should expect another quake of that size, if not larger, to hit that region again sometime soon. Maybe it'll shorten the day by an hour. You know, we'll have 23 hours in the day. But really, pretty impressive that an earthquake actually has the power to do that. And that's an 8.8. Never mind something any higher than that. All right. So it is 6:26. Let me do this. I'm going to give my guest, John DiNardo, a buzz. Bear with me, people. I've never dialed out on this system here. So let me try to figure this out real quick. Where am I? Okay, here I am. And let me get John's number. And there we are. Bear with me. Here I go. Let me try to dial out. Okay. 9-7. I can't say his number on air. That wouldn't be good. Eight.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Yes.
Hi, this is Darren.
Hi, Darren.
All right, so the dial-out worked. Very, very good. All right, we are on air, and everyone's patiently waiting for us to get into the whole Planet X thing and see what's going on out there, waiting for our update. I think the last time you were on the program, John, was back in August or September, I think. So I was explaining to the audience that I figured it was time for us to get re-updated with all the Planet X info and all the Earth events that we've seen happen since the last time you were on the program. Before we get started, just do me a favor and tell people a little bit about your background, those people that haven't heard you before.
Formerly in 4.5 years in the Marine Corps, my specialty was electronics, aviation electronics. I then became a civilian and got a degree in a bachelor's degree in science education, specializing in physics. Taught high school physics, and then went back into my real favorite subject, electronics, for the remainder of my career, doing engineering work and also technical work, technicians. Troubleshooting and analysis. So that pretty much covers my career. It involved both the physics and the electronics experience and education. It involved a knowledge of theory of electricity and magnetism. Now, both of these studies are a major portion of physics and also electronics, and they also apply to the Planet X phenomenon, because we're now learning, although NASA is slow to change, or I should say mainstream science is slow to change their outmoded and recognizably false doctrines that they've held for so long, because nobody likes to admit that they were wrong, especially after all the political rewards that come from establishing a theory of the universe and the solar system, which has been very profitable for them, and therefore they are reluctant to admit that they were wrong and that there are additional forces of electricity and magnetism that strongly affect all the planets, including Earth.
And that non-admission also, besides most likely reaping some profits for them and keeping jobs for them, also most likely keeps them alive in some circumstances.
So, you're right. And people will defy the truth and deny the truth when it comes to their own personal gain and their prestige, monetary gain and personal prestige. You find the same thing happened centuries ago during the time of Galileo, when he was threatened with death for presenting his principles, correct principles of astronomy and physics, But that's how humankind is. So we have to be very untrusting and suspicious of mainstream anything, whether it be medicine, mainstream medicine, which is killing literally millions of people because of their greed based upon false principles. And
yes.
Medicine, science, etc. So don't people who respect scientists just are not fully aware of how untrustworthy they really, many of them really are.
Well, here's
especially the ones who ride at the steering, that who control the steering wheel.
Right. You know what I say is, look, as far as mainstream science, mainstream archaeology goes, you know, as soon as one of those guys wants to cop to the fact that there's helicopters and flying saucers and jets carved into Osiris's tomb, you know, then I'm willing to listen to them. But in the meantime, they just say that's an interpretation of something, and it's really not a helicopter or a jet plane when it clearly is. So, you know, when they ignore things like that, and obviously there's much more blinding examples of that, but, you know, it basically discredits them completely, in my opinion.
Yeah, speaking of ancient helicopters and ancient artifacts and archaeological finds, there's a guy named Brent Miller who's with the Horizon Project, thehorizonproject.com, and he's been studying about Planet X and the Earth changes, he and a team of scientists. And he had mentioned what you had, something related to what you spoke about, and that is that they had flying machines thousands of years ago. And he was explaining how humankind reaches a point of technological development, of high technology, over a period of many, many centuries. And then this Planet X comes by, this wrecking ball comes and destroys the whole monopoly board,
right?
Knocks everything over, and humankind resorts then is immediately thrown back into the Stone Ages, wherein a few survivors have to pick up the pieces, start digging, you know, with rocks or whatever, shovels, planting and trying to survive, and then they eke their way back, crawl their way back to high technology civilization again over many, many centuries. So it happens over and over again. And that's why they had flying machines thousands of years ago. That's why you see these pictures on ancient archaeological relics. So this is one, you know, I'm glad we got into this subject because it probably is a foundational principle that this planet, this wrecking ball comes by and it just totally obliterates civilization every periodic, every regular time interval. And that time interval happens to be 36 and a half centuries, which is the period, the orbital period of this huge brown dwarf star, which is on a cometary orbit into our solar system and then back out of our solar system. And I like to draw the analogy. Right now, when I explain it just that way, it seems hard to really believe that a huge brown dwarf star can act like a comet, swinging in and out like a pendulum over a regular, predictable time interval. But if you consider a tennis match, you're watching a tennis match on television, and there's one player is in the foreground and the other player is in the background. That player in the foreground would represent our sun. The player in the background would represent a distant sun, a distant dead sun, estimated to be at least 50 billion miles out there. And this was actually stated in an encyclopedia, the New Science and Invention Encyclopedia, the 1987 edition, which was actually, this page was published in Mark Hazelwood's book, Blindsided, a book about planet, the first landmark book that the public could read about Planet X. It was in his book, Mark Hazelwood's book, Blindsided. So now where did the New Science and Invention Encyclopedia, did I call it magazine? If I did, I meant to say New Science and Invention Encyclopedia. Now these people, you know, obviously are oriented toward scientific information. So where would they have gotten this information about a dead sun 50 billion miles out? Well, obviously they got it from people in NASA, astronomers, probably people in NASA before, well, maybe a little bit after NASA was told, was muzzled, but still before they were tightly controlled.
Right.
87. And that's where we can probably assume that that information is correct. Now, I've got the book right in front of me. I can probably turn to it real quickly. And I think it also shows a picture of Planet X in this encyclopedia. Let me see if I can turn to it real quickly.
Okay.
But the point is, this came. This information was released, revealed by scientific people in a scientific encyclopedia. Here it is, page 17. Let me put my glasses on here because this is kind of small print.
And what book is this again, John?
The title of the book is Blindsided.
Oh, okay.
Now,
okay.
The full title is actually Blindsided, Planet X Passes in 2003.
And
I was wrong. He got the date wrong, but the event was right. Go ahead.
Okay. And what you're reading is an excerpt from another book?
No, an excerpt from the book. Okay, well, here's what it is. The book Blindsided by Mark Hazelwood. This is really, I'll tell you, I'm glad, you know, as we talk, we get these ideas. And I recall going to Amazon.com and finding this book for about a penny, 2-3 cents. Of course, you have to pay shipping, a few bucks shipping.
Right.
But please, I mean, it's a tremendous bargain, an amazing bargain. Mark Hazelwood, H-A-Z-L-E, Wood.
Okay.
H-A-Z-L-E-W-O-O-D. Book is Blindsided. Forget the rest of the title.
Okay.
It's easier to remember Blindsided. Like we're going to get blindsided, which is probably what appears to be happening.
Yes.
This book was way back in 2001, and he was a little bit too early on the date, you know. But somebody tells me, oh, it doesn't exist because Mark Hazelwood said it was coming in 2003. It never came. So my answer always is, well, if the bus is late, does that mean you could stand out there in front of the path of where the bus is supposed to stop and not get run over by it when it does come?
Right. You know it's coming eventually.
Right. Right. So, I mean, the bus is late, but it's definitely coming.
Okay.
Let's see. In this picture, page 17, New Science and Invention Magazine, an encyclopedia, I keep on saying. It's encyclopedia. The dead star, 50 billion miles away from our sun. It's showing a diagram. And then it shows the 10th planet, which has been named by astronomers worldwide ever since 1900, when Percival Lowell established the Lowell Observatory specifically dedicated to finding this unseen but felt, strongly gravitationally felt planet. It's been called Planet X by the entire astronomy community for 110 years. The diagram here, the New Science and Invention Encyclopedia, shows the distant dead star 50 billion miles away, and it shows in between our solar system and the dead star this 10th planet, which at the time, it was 1987, it was, you know, this is an important clue, I never realized this. This thing was published in 87, and it's saying in 87 that this thing is 4.7 billion miles away. Now, they knew, you know, that's kind of a precise measurement. The people in NASA knew, who gave this information to the encyclopedia, they realized it was that far out because they had, again, they were doing calculations. They had the highest technology at their disposal back in 1987. Plus, they had sighted it, this planet, in 1983 with their infrared astronomical satellite that they had launched into polar orbit around the Earth. It was orbiting around. They never tell you which pole it was. It was probably the South Pole, because that's where you view it coming in through from below the South Pole.
Okay.
So this infrared astronomical satellite, IRAS, was specifically launched to site Planet X. It indeed accomplished its mission and found it. And based upon that sighting and other mathematical and knowledge and calculations. They figured in 1987 in the New Science Invention Encyclopedia that it was 4.7 billion miles away.
Yeah, the 0.7 kind of makes it a little more exact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this never struck me, but they really had some very precise information at that time. So there you go. This even further bolsters the evidence that we have that this thing does exist. And what else it's showing in this diagram is the Pioneer 10 space probe and the Pioneer 11 space probe. Now, in 1979, this was 8 years before this encyclopedia was published. In 1979, NASA launched two space probes, again, specifically dedicated to finding Planet X. That's how concerned they were about it, just finding this one object. I mean, all the rest of the galaxies and stars didn't mean much to them. Maybe even the space program didn't mean that much to them compared to this search for Planet X. They sent up Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 to go far out, way out, and continue traveling. And I guess even after they ran out of fuel, maybe they would continue because in space there is no gravity. And, you know, their momentum would propel them far, far out. I don't know how much fuel it had. But these things were to go into deep space. I think they may still be traveling. It's just that we lost radio contact, of course, because they're too far out.
Right.
Pick up radio signals. But this Pioneer 10 and 11 were sent out. Pioneer 10 was sent to the deepest regions beyond the outer limits of the solar system toward the direction of Planet X. Similarly, or conversely, I should say, the Pioneer 11 space probe was sent out in just the opposite direction toward the other side of the solar system. So one of them went out toward 2 o'clock. Pioneer 10, we'll say, went out toward 2 o'clock if you're looking down on the solar system. And the Pioneer 11 went out toward 8 o'clock, which would be roughly 180 degrees in the opposite direction.
Yep.
Now, the reason they did that was they needed Pioneer 11 to show to be the control model, just to show that, hey, this thing is going out to space, there's no huge body near it, and its trajectory is pretty much straight. It's not curving at all. They needed to prove that, sort of like a control experiment.
Okay.
At the same time, Pioneer 10 was to go out and show that indeed there was a tremendous gravitational pull on the Pioneer 10 space probe. And the pull was where they had mathematically calculated Planet X to be. So that's where they were sending it out in that direction, where they had calculated it to be. And indeed, sure enough, their gravitational pull on the Pioneer 10 space probe showed that Planet X was indeed there with its, and it gave them indications, I guess, as to its mass, because the greater the pull, the gravitational pull on an object, a given distance away, the greater the mass of that pulling object must be. So this gave them an indication of the mass of Planet X too. Well, anyway,
what did they find as far as mass goes? Do you know?
You know, they never reveal that, never tell you anything. I mean, we pay billions and billions of dollars to NASA, and it goes into the elites. Little programs, space programs, and they keep all the knowledge, and they, you know, they use it against us. This is just as they always do with our taxes. They use it for themselves and against us. They, you know, we are being forced to pay for the shovel that buries us.
I mean, yeah, if you look at it, and you just made total sense. I mean, all the money that's been funneled into NASA, and really, what have we gotten out of the entire space program, really, as a species? I don't think we've really gotten a whole lot. It's just a whole bunch of, oh, there's some cool stuff out there, but really nothing to worry about, kind of, right?
Yeah, that's
I mean,
right.
We really haven't made any, you know, incredible discoveries or, you know, nothing that really affects us directly. And, you know, you would think that they would stop funneling money into that program long ago if there was really nothing but, you know, cool stuff to look at out there.
we've got a bunch of criminals that, you know, that have usurped the power, usurped our government long, long ago.
Yes.
And these criminals are, you know, are destroying us and killing many of us. I mean, just look at the wars they have engineered, they have concocted, and sent our people, our young men and women out to die in. Every one of them was concocted by these criminals, these monsters, banksters, basically.
Yep.
Wars are profitable, and also territory. Just think of all the natural resources, all the tin, all the copper, all the gold, all the oil that they've gotten from these foreign adventures under the transparent falsehood that we are fighting for democracy to free those people.
Yes.
And it's so that we've got a bunch of monster devils ruling us.
Well, we
that's
do.
People
and
need to wake up because we're in trouble.
Right, and that's, you know, I spoke about this before I gave you a call tonight. You know, it provides a disconnect for people because they can't fathom that people would purposely hurt or allow, you know, millions of people to be hurt. They just because they themselves are not that type of person, and so people just think, well, I really don't think anybody would do that. But you know, I use the example of an oppressive dictator. You know, Pol Pot. You know, Mao, Stalin, Idi Amin. I mean, you know, Stalin. Any of those people.
George
Hitler,
Herbert Walker Bush.
Yep, I included him and Barack Obama in my preface of this earlier in the program. Yeah, those guys. You know, but when you think about it, you and I, as I said before, don't have an inherent need to control everybody and everything around us. We just want to be left alone to live our lives as peacefully and as happily and as fulfilled as we possibly can. And so that's how most people, I think, are. And then so they don't think that, well, why would somebody do that? You know, I can't explain why somebody would do that. But the biggest mass murders in history have been heads of government, not these serial killers that we see on A&E being profiled in, like, you know, the world's most dangerous serial killers. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer, was he an evil guy? Oh, yeah. Did he do a lot of harm? Definitely. But he pales in comparison to Stalin, okay, or to George Bush, or to Barack Obama and the deaths they have under their belts.
Yes, I mean, that's a profound point you brought up. It's extremely important that we develop your point and show it graphically, vividly, and convincingly to as many people as possible, because it will save lives if we can get it across to people. Even when you say that, there are people out there, again, the majority, unfortunately, the majority of Americans are sheeple, and they may have a glimmer of credence. They may place a glimmer of credence in what you say, but not enough to really motivate them, not enough to activate them into doing something. They'll probably think, well, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. And they'll just go on watching their ball games. And eventually they'll be poisoned with the fluoride, and their children will be killed with the vaccines, and they'll never even realize who killed them. They'll just go to their graves.
Just thinking that's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's the way.
Look at all the people who went to their graves in the First World War, thinking they were fighting for freedom. Look at all the people who went to their graves in the Second World War, thinking they were fighting for freedom, not realizing that Pearl Harbor was set up by the power elite. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew all about it in advance. Secretary of State Cordell Hull told. And I've got it on videotape. I've got the old man, as an old man, Joseph Lieb, New York, Washington Post, a commentator, one of the most famous commentators in the country at the time, and he was befriended by Secretary of State Cordell Hull. Cordell Hull wanted to relieve his conscience by taking Joseph Lieb, the Washington Post commentator, to the park where they had privacy, and told him, he said, the Japanese are going to attack Pearl Harbor. This was several months before the attack.
Yeah.
He says, I am telling you because if there's any scandal directed toward me, I want you to plead my case, to tell them that I told you this and to help exonerate me. I guess he was sucked into it by the banksters, the cabal. And, of course, Roosevelt was just a helpless puppet in their hands.
Oh, yeah. He was horrible.
He did whatever they told him to do. You know,
yes, he did.
He had to do it. And, of course, he was the kind of person who would obey orders. So just think of all the people who died. They killed 3,000 sailors and Marines in Pearl Harbor. I've got this documentary called Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. It was done by, you know, on the A&E, Arts and Entertainment Channel, and hosted by Ed, I'm trying to remember his name.
Ed Asner?
No, it was another guy. I forget his name, but it'll come to me. Famous historian, and it was also replayed again, I think, on the History Channel, and it was narrated by Roger Mudd, the CBS news commentator,
mm-hmm.
television news commentator. So it's been around. Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. You can see it on YouTube.
Okay.
This is one way to convince people. Well, I guess we're getting off the subject, but it's an important subject. Well, what you said is we've got to show people graphically they are going to be killed. We've got to stand up because people are actually scheming to kill many millions of us.
Yes, they are. That's been
and
the plan.
That ties in with Planet X. You know
yes.
how? Planet X is coming to kill us, too. And
yeah.
they are going underground. They're going to protect themselves and leave us out here to, as they say, twist slowly in the wind.
The solar winds. Okay.
Yeah, the solar wind.
So
right.
I have a question. You know, the thing we get asked about a lot is, well, look, if it was close and if it was out there, then we would have amateur astronomers putting pictures up on the internet and we would see it. Now, let me just the more I understand this, as you said earlier in the show, this is coming up. Supposedly Planet X is coming up from underneath us, which is why we have a huge observatory in the South Pole, right?
That's correct. The South Pole telescope was built at a cost of many millions of dollars in the harshest conditions imaginable. This would have been a Herculean task for any engineering group.
John, what was the official reason for what was the official story, the official reason for building that observatory on the South Pole?
As far as I know, they never gave any. It's been secret.
Okay.
It's been very secret. It may have leaked out in a couple news publications passingly and, you know, buried somewhere in some remote, obscure news publication. I doubt it. I think it's been a pretty well-kept secret. That's the way they are. They're not very bright. When they want to lie to us, they just ignore. They just ignore the truth and try to pretend that it doesn't exist. So they're not very smart. They're just very evil. They put up that South Pole telescope under the most harsh conditions you can imagine. Never would any legitimate astronomy team do such a thing because it's just impractical. You could go to New Zealand, which is pretty close to the South Pole, if you want to observe an object coming in below the soles of the feet of Fat Man Planet Earth. You can go to New Zealand, where you've got the Black Birch Observatory, and that incidentally was used. That observatory was used by Dr. Robert S. Harrington, the late and probably most people believe murdered chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. Dr. Harrington, in 1988, wrote in his memo, we have the paper, I have the paper, it's on the internet, that he published stating that he was planning to dispatch an appropriate telescope to the southern location on planet Earth, which turned out to be Black Birch Observatory in New Zealand, somewhere close to the South Pole where they could look down below the soles of the feet of Fat Man Earth and see this object coming in below us. Dr. Harrington, in October of 1990, said in his paper, he's dispatching a telescope to a southern location, and during the appropriate viewing months, the months where it is possible to view it, which would be May and June, well, that would be May and June of the coming year from 1990. That would be May, June of 1991.
Okay.
It would do the viewing, would take the photographic pictures, and then it would take pictures of that same point in the sky several nights in a row. Now, when you look at a star-studded sky, if you take, well, the Earth is going to move a little bit, but I guess they compensated for that. But aside from the Earth shifting a little bit during over one or two or three nights, you're going to look out at that sky and those stars will not appear to be moving.
Okay.
However, if there's an object in the midst of billions and billions of stars, you're never going to see an object if you take one photograph. How can you detect it? But if you take several photographs of that same stationary star field, and there's an object moving, what you can do is take the three transparencies of those photographs, overlay them exactly one on top of the other, and then shine a light into the side of each plate, flicker that light, rotate, turn the light on and off, rotating back and forth to illuminate first one plate and then the other, rapidly, more than maybe, you know, maybe several, every quarter of a second. The human eye will pick up the motion, the change in position of one bright object, one object amidst many other stationary objects. And that's called blink comparison in astronomy. That's what Dr. Harrington dispatched that telescope to, and the instructions were given to the astronomers at the Black Birch Observatory in New Zealand to do that. And he said when the plates are returned, these photographic plates are returned, he would observe them. That would be, and he would analyze them and determine, is this planet approaching us? Now, this was not the $64,000 question, but the $64 trillion question.
Mm-hmm.
If that's as much, if that's all the money that's on planet Earth, because the future of planet Earth rested upon determining.
Oh, they just make money, John. Money's unlimited. Money's unlimited on Earth. We just make it.
Right, exactly. So it's worth the question is worth even more than $64 trillion.
Yes.
Because is this bullet coming at us or is it not? Well, if it's coming at us, we're dead. If it's not coming at us, we're okay.
Well, I think it's I think it's easy to see. I mean, if this planet's passing, it obviously does not wipe out every single person or hasn't in the past because we're still here.
90%. The other 10% will regenerate.
Right, right. So, you know, it's some people will make it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the past, they figure like maybe 5 to 10% survived during past incursions of this wrecking ball, the celestial wrecking ball.
And
that 5% would pick up. Well, the last one that came in wasn't that bad. The one during the Israelites' exodus from Egypt.
Well, what was I going to say here? I kind of lost my train of thought. It's going to matter how affected our planet is to where the Earth is in relation to Planet X as it passes, right? Where Earth is going to be in its orbit around the sun to where Planet X passes by us, right?
Right, right. The closer it is, the more devastating. The closer it comes, the more devastating it will be.
Okay.
So we could be lucky because, you know, just picture this. You're driving along on a highway, right? And all of us have done this. Visualize a time when you've been driving along on a highway and you go under an overpass. On that overpass, there are cars passing along. And did you ever notice, like, sometimes coincidentally, you'll pass right under the overpass when there's a truck or a vehicle coming directly above you? Well, you know, if you're lucky, I mean, sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes you're not at that same point where that vehicle is right above you. Sometimes you are at that point. Similarly, the Earth is like on a rotational highway going around the sun, one revolution per year. Now, when Planet X comes over us on that overpass in the sky, it could be passing right overhead as we're making our rotational, or revolution, I should say, around the sun. It may be the month of, say, May 15th, for example. I'm just making that up. But suppose they pass over. We happen to be in a particular point on a 363-degree orbit around the sun, And at one particular point, say, for example, on May 15th, Planet X may be hurtling right above us, 15 million miles above us. Well, we'll get the worst devastation from the gravitational, the electrostatic, and electromagnetic force fields that produced by that huge brown dwarf star. But if we happen to be on the other half of the other side or farther away, say, not in the month of May, but in the month of September or October, we'd be lucky we would not be close enough to get any damage. To give you an example, I saw the precursor, what the Hopi Indians call the precursor to Planet X, much, much smaller comet called Comet, today called Comet Hale-Bopp, discovered by two men of those names, Hale and Bopp. Of course, the Indians, the Hopi Indians, saw it come in many centuries ago when it came in as sort of like the vanguard or the point man.
Right.
Planet X.
Right. I think the Hopis describe it as, I can't remember the names they give it, but the two brothers come first, and then I forget how they describe the actual, they call it the blue star. I can't remember the name they gave
Kachina?
That too. Kachina, yes. Yes.
That's what the Hopis say, right?
Right, yep.
And they said a blue, the blue star is the big guy, right?
Yeah.
And they say there's a little guy that comes in ahead of him.
Right. I thought they said two, but go ahead.
Oh, two guys. Well, actually, Hale-Bopp, I think, did have a moon surrounding it, you know, this comet Hale-Bopp that came in March of 1997. Had a moon, so maybe that's the other one. The two guys that came in earlier. I believe the Hopi say that from their legends that this Hale-Bopp, or what is now Hale-Bopp, comes in about 12 years before the big brown dwarf star, Planet X.
Okay.
Now that would have been 1997. Would have been it should have been due. The big guy should have been due in 2009 then.
Okay.
But I guess there's some time variability.
Well, we're also going by
various things.
We're going by our modern day calendars also. I mean, right now.
Well, actually,
when you say 97 and 2009, I mean, I'm not, and I have no idea. I'm just throwing that out there. You know, possibly the calendars may have differed. I'm not quite sure. I thought I also heard. Was I talking to you?
Well, Indian calendar, yeah, might have been different. Okay, I never thought about that.
Right, because when we were speaking the other day, I thought we said, I'm pretty sure it was you, said that, I want to say the Arabic calendar, or I can't remember what.
Well, there's the Gregorian calendar, and which we use, I believe, and the Julian calendar.
Which would actually make the year 2012 the year 2011. Was it you that I was talking to about that? Or somebody?
Yeah, somebody said that. I'm not sure. Even Mark Hazelwood said, he might have said there in his book, I think there are a couple of years difference between the two calendars. That's a good point. I mean, who knows what kind of calendar the Hopi Indians used. I hadn't thought about that. But also, then you've got another variability, which is the tail drag on Planet X. If that thing picks up a lot of comets in space as it's passing through, because it's like a gravitational vacuum cleaner in deep space.
Right.
It pulls in things like objects, celestial bodies, like a magnet would pull in iron filings.
Yeah.
As it travels in. So.
So we have a debris field.
A lot of bodies. That's
going
to slow it down, like a drag chute on a military jet aircraft landing on an aircraft carrier.
Sure. Now
drag chute.
Now let's think about that for a second, John. If it's in its secular orbit like that, would it attract more and more and more over time? So might it slow it down and slow it down and slow it down?
That's what I was thinking. That's what I was thinking. Because it seems it only makes sense that it would, like a magnet, it keeps on going, through a field of iron filings over a period of centuries. It's going to pick up more and more iron filings and get more and more massive.
Right.
However, here's the thing. By Sir Isaac Newton's second law of motion, which states that the acceleration of a body is equal to the force, is directly proportional to the force on that body, which means that the greater the force, the greater the acceleration. But inversely, the acceleration is inversely proportional to the mass, meaning the greater the mass of a body, the less the acceleration. Okay?
Okay.
So it's F equals, A equals F over M. Acceleration of body equals the force applied to that body divided by its mass.
Okay.
Now, suppose it picks up a lot of mass, okay? According to that formula, the Newton's second law of motion, as the mass increases, that's in the denominator of this ratio. The M is on the bottom, so M gets bigger. F is going to decrease. I'm sorry, A, the acceleration will decrease, and that would slow it down. But here's the thing that counteracts that. As the mass of a body increases, we know by the universal law of gravitation that the greater the mass of a body A to body B, the greater the gravitational force of attraction between those two bodies, okay? So the sun is staying at the same huge mass.
Right.
Mass approximately equal to 330,000 Earth masses. So the sun is about one-third of a million Earth masses. That stays the same. But planet X, let's say it gets heavier and heavier as it sucks up all these little celestial bodies, these big celestial bodies, as it's traveling through deep space, it gets more and more massive. As it's getting massive, its gravitational force of attraction to the sun is commensurately increasing.
Okay.
So you see what's happening?
Yes.
M gets larger, F gets equally larger. So the ratio F over M remains the constant. So it's like taking the numbers 3 divided by 1. I'm sorry. You would have to equal it, but increase it by the same amount each time. Say 3 divided by 1, and if you double it, it would be 6 divided by 2. Or triple would be 9 divided by 3. It would still be the same ratio.
Okay.
F over M. So therefore, that would equal the same acceleration. You know, a good example of that is gravity. When you drop something, Galileo proved when he dropped something, I believe, off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Remember that famous story?
Yes.
He wanted to prove that if you take a big rock and a small rock and drop them, hold them out in your hands from a high tower and at equal heights and release them at the same instant, they would both hit the ground at the same time. And everybody said, "You're crazy. The big rock is going to hit the ground sooner than the small rock." That's what I would have thought, you know.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So he proved it. He proved that they both hit the ground at the same time.
Right.
I mean, in a vacuum. Suppose there was no air to provide air resistance in a vacuum. They would both hit the ground at the same time. So now what's the rock? Well, one rock, let's say the Earth represents the sun. Okay, that's the one big rock. And the other big rock is one of the rocks that you drop from the tower. And we'll call that rock Planet X. So whether you drop a heavy Planet X or a lighter Planet X, they're both going to reach the sun at the same time. Therefore, the orbital period, the time it takes to get to the sun, is still going to be, you know, half of 36 and a half centuries.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Now, speaking of the sun, you and I were talking about that, and we were both complaining about the amount of snow we've been shoveling lately. And you mentioned to me that I might not have to be doing that for much longer.
Oh, yeah.
So you talked about some solar scorching. But before we get into that, let me ask you this question. There's been a lot of big eruptions on the sun over the past year. But most of these eruptions have happened on the far side of the sun, facing away from us. I'm just wondering.
Oh, that's a good point. You've checked that out. I didn't know that. But you've actually, okay, good.
Well, you know, John, it's not like, let me just explain myself. I haven't done any deep research here. I have an app on my iPhone, okay? It's called 3D Sun, and it gives alerts to what's happening on the sun. It's from NASA's heliophysics department. So, you know, that's how I keep track of, you know, some sun activity. And I've just noticed that, you know, they'll say we're having a massive eruption, but all these eruptions seem to be happening on the opposite side of the sun from Earth. So I'm wondering, and I have no idea, do you have any idea why they're consistently on the other side, And I'm happy about that. I'm just wondering if there's any reasoning for that you know of.
Well, you know, that's an important point important fact that you've brought to my attention. I wasn't aware of that because I don't have a lot of time to study the solar activity. But that, let me think now. What's going to happen is when you talk about the opposite side of the sun, let's draw a visual analogy. What would be a good example? You're on a merry-go-round. Does everybody ever, maybe, I guess everybody's experienced the merry-go-round? I'd like to bring in and draw up an analogy that everybody has experienced in their own life. Going around a circle or something, maybe a racetrack or whatever. Okay, mm-hmm. Suppose you're on a horse riding around a race on a racetrack. And the opposite side, of the center of the track would be at one point in your travel around the track. You could look over and say, well, that's over to the east. The opposite side, let's say the opposite side of the track would be east of you, and you're on the western side. Now you ride your horse and you go all the way around, halfway around that track. Now you're on the eastern side. Mm-hmm. And you're looking over, and you're looking toward the west, right? The opposite side to you now turns out to be the western side. So it's hard to relate to determine what side of the sun is the opposite side.
Well, no, what I'm saying is, it's always on the opposite side of the earth. And, that, you know, my first instinct, before I realized it, you know, thought a little harder and said, oh, no, it's round and we go around it. I was like, well, maybe, you know, Planet X is, you know, pulling these things, or they're being attracted to it. But then I'm like, no, dummy, we're traveling around it and it's round. So we're on that side of the sun eventually.
Well, see, right, it would make sense. What you're saying could be an important clue, because if you found out that these comets crashing into the sun, or I'm sorry, what did you say was solar eruptions?
Yeah, you know, these big plasma eruptions.
Some double
eruptions. We had plasma rain on the sun the other day, and it eventually collapsed and exploded in a massive explosion.
Plasma rain.
Yes, yes, yes.
You mean rain coming down, plasma being sucked
into
the sun.
The picture of it looked like almost like a rainbow of plasma looping up from the sun, and you could see it falling back down into the sun from the
I know what you mean, like a big pop fly ball.
Kind of,
maybe somebody hit a pop fly from the sun, and it came back down and hit the sun again.
Right.
That would be an eruption that originated with the sun. Okay, that would be activity on the sun caused by the sun, I would think. Again, it takes a lot of. I'm not a solar. I haven't studied the sun. I could make it a daily activity, but it takes a bit of study to really know about these things.
Right. It's just
from
a question.
What you're telling me, it looks like from this is caused by the sun itself. However, if you get something, there are excitations of the sun that are caused by comets coming by them, and the comet gets close to it gravitationally, that comet is going to be sucked into the sun. I mean, it's, again, the sun is a huge, it makes Planet X's gravitational pull look like nothing, because the Planet X, because the sun is 1/3 of a million Earth masses. So mass being proportional to force, gravitational attraction, the sun is incredibly gravitationally strong. And
right.
If you comets come in, they're going to get sucked right into that sun. There's no way they can escape.
Right.
It's like getting sucked into a black hole almost.
Yeah, and we've seen that a number of times over the past couple of years. But no, I wasn't thinking that Planet X was causing the sun eruptions, what I was thinking was, you know, I think this is, you know, sun activity, but when these big filaments or eruptions are happening on the sun as they, you know, kind of protrude out into space, you know, I was wondering if they were being pulled in a certain direction because of something, you know, when I asked that question about the opposite side. But
Gary, could you excuse me for just about 10 seconds? I think somebody, I have to call my wife real quick. I think somebody's on the line, but I'll be back in about 10 seconds, okay?
Okay, yeah,
right,
no problem, John. All right, so I guess we're taking a little break from John there for a second. He's got some husbandly duties to attend to. I wrote down some of the questions that I saw in chat, so you guys know I'll be asking those. I'm going to start going down my list of questions now so we can get into some hardcore Planet X information. So if there's anything that anybody wants to ask, if there's any questions that you have on your mind, please.
Sorry for the interruption.
Oh, that's all right. I'm just going to give people our call-in number, John, so if anybody has any questions, they can call in. I've written down a few questions I've seen in the chat room. But just if anybody has any questions, tonight's call-in number is 917-889-3064. 917-889-3064. Okay, John.
Now, on the, you know, like if we, there's a logical, one logical explanation might be that when there are comets, if there are comets crashing into the sun and they appear to be on the far side, they are on the far side from planet Earth, crashing into the far side of the sun, it could be that they all happen around a certain time period, maybe a month, say maybe the month of May and June, as an example.
Right.
And we happen to be at a point in the orbit where those comets are fortunately crashing into the far side of the sun, not into the near side relative to us.
Right.
And that could be because Planet X is coming in. We know it's coming in through the solar disk, that eclipse, what's called the ecliptic plane, which, if you can visualize this, it's like, let me try to draw an example. Say you're on a lake, a huge placid lake. It's a round circular lake, very big. In the center of the lake is a bright light at the very center that represents the sun. And you have all these different rowboats going around in a circle, each rowboat at a different distance from the center light. That represents the planets orbiting around the sun.
Right.
And now you get to one point in the orbit, and Planet X is coming in from down below. Let's say Planet X is represented by a huge porpoise, okay? You ever see these fish that come shooting up from underneath the water, and they come flying up through the surface and up into the air, and they go looping up and then nosediving back down into the water? Everybody's seen pictures of that, right?
Films. Right, right.
A porpoise, maybe, I think, is probably a good example, or a great white shark. Well, visualize Planet X as something like that, and this lake is very, very deep. So this porpoise is way, way down below the bottom, near the bottom of the lake. It takes a long time for it to swim straight upward, or at least coming upward at an angle. And then all of a sudden it penetrates the surface from underneath and comes flying up, shooting up in the air and looping, headed toward the sun, but over the top of that center light in the middle of the lake, which is the sun. And then loops over the sun, that light in the middle of the lake, and then comes back down again, plunges nose first into the water to return deep, deep from where it came.
Mm-hmm.
That is a good representation of what Planet X does. Comes up, we are on the surface. Our solar system is like merely the surface of the lake. Just the
right.
Surface alone. And we just continually revolve around, like, our rowboat, Planet Earth, is at a particular distance from that center light, and we continually row around that, in a circle around the sun, and takes us 365 days, 1 year, to make one complete revolution.
And here's that damn porpoise barreling up from underneath us again.
Right, and the porpoise now is farther out from the sun. It's going to come up now, not closer to the sun, but when it punches through from underneath, punches through the surface and goes up into the air, it's going to be farther out from the sun than we are. In fact, it's going to be out near that rowboat planet Jupiter, just
okay.
a little bit closer in from Jupiter, because what the ancients tell us, that's where it came in the past. Ancient
okay.
astronomers had determined that, and they had written it in their annals. One of them is titled the, the records of the, by R. Campbell Thompson, the records of the magicians and astronomers of Babylon and Nineveh, something like that. Zechariah Sitchin talks about it in his book. Let me see, I've got
yes.
the book right here.
Rest in peace, Mr. Sitchin, by the way.
Yeah.
He just passed recently.
I mean, he had some, of course, some of his information was correct. His spiritual information was really wrong. Here's the book. I just remember that page because I refer to it a lot. But it's called, the book is called The Twelfth Planet by Zechariah Sitchin, S-I-T-C-H-I-N. The word sit and chin.
Yep.
Together. And let's see, a page. I think it's page 240. You've got a lot of diagrams in here from the ancients, the ancient people, too. The great planet at its appearance. Indeed, all the peoples of the ancient world considered the periodic nearing of the 12th planet as a sign. This is reading from the book, page 242.
Okay.
The ancient peoples considered the periodic nearing of the 12th planet as a sign of upheavals, great changes, and new eras. The Mesopotamian texts spoke of the planet's periodic appearance as an anticipated, predictable, and observable event. And here's what they wrote. The great planet at his appearance is dark red. The heaven he divides in half and stands as Nibiru. What they mean, this is my commentary, what they mean is the heaven he divides in half is that it comes right through the center of the solar system, not as far out as Pluto, but not as near in as Mercury.
Okay.
Not as close to the sun, but not real far. Somewhere in between the midway point, which would be between Jupiter and the asteroid belt. Now, as you go out, here's the succession of planets starting from the sun. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, the asteroid belt, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Okay, so if you remember the asteroid belt, Mars, Earth, Mars, asteroid belt, Jupiter. In between the asteroid belt and Jupiter is where this thing comes in. That's what they're saying. He divides the heavens in half and stands as Nibiru. This is all very cryptic until you start to put it into an astronomical context and you look at the solar system. Stands as Nibiru? Well, the word Nibiru in the ancient Sumerian text, these are Sumerian people who lived thousands of years ago. They occupied what is now the nation of Iraq. The Sumerians called it Nibiru. In their language, Nibiru, N-I-B-I-R-U, means planet of the crossing. So it crosses our solar system. It plows its way right through the center, and then comes right through, sort of like a spectator. Well, let's go back to the boat analogy. Here we got these rowboats going around, and all of a sudden this porpoise comes in and disturbs everybody, comes flying through and straight over, not following a circular path like all the other boats, not being courteous and minding the rules of the road, but coming right across and going over everybody else's path in the air and diving over the sun back down again. So
right.
That's why they call it Nibiru, because it's a planet of the crossing. It crosses straight through, not around, and causes great mayhem. Okay, that's the Mesopotamian text, to quote. Sitchin goes on to state, many of the texts dealing with the planet's arrival were omen texts, prophesying the effect the event would have upon Earth and mankind. R. Campbell Thompson, in The Reports of the Magicians and Astronomers of Nineveh and Babylon, reproduced several such texts which traced the progress of the planet as it ringed, quote, ringed at the station of Jupiter and arrived at the point of crossing Nibiru. Again, there it is. It comes in, punches through our solar disk, the surface of the lake, at around Jupiter, a little bit inward from Jupiter.
But John, aren't these just interpretations in ancient texts? No, I'm kidding. Of course they're not. They're a little too specific for that. Okay, look, we have about a half hour left. What I'd like to do is let's get into some more current events that have taken place, and maybe and discuss how they possibly relate to this. And I have a couple questions. Let me just get a question out from chat, and I'm sure that you've gotten this question a million times. But what do you think of the Mayan calendar in relation to this?
I don't know. I mean, I'm hearing from a lot of sources, so many different sources that are credible and reputable, that this Mayan calendar may very well be correct. These Mayans had an uncanny ability to measure this, to deal with astronomy and time.
Right.
And this is everything I've been reading. I haven't gotten into deep study, but I've been following a lot of experts on the subject of the Mayan calendar. They could be very, very accurate. Now, whether when they try to get specifically to one day, December 21st, 2012, they say is the end of the world, or the end of the world as we know it. That's the end of their calendar.
Right.
December
21st,
2012. I would say it's going to be somewhere, and this is all that matters. We don't have to know that it's going to be exactly December 21st, 2012. I decrease my credence accordingly when they get very specific, like one particular day. But all I can say is they're pretty close, and that's close enough.
Right.
Could be 2013, could be 2014, could be 2011. I hope it's not 2011.
Yeah, me either.
So somewhere around there is close enough for me to be worried.
Well, you know what? I mean, look, most ancient prophetic texts all make a reference to this type of event, and they're all fairly similar. One thing I don't know is if it's true or not, because I saw it on the History Channel, so I take that with a grain of salt. But when I was watching a special on the a couple weeks ago about the Hopi Blue Star Prophecy, it said that the Mayans and the Hopis had trade routes, and that's maybe why they're prophecies seem the same. Now, when I heard that, number one, I'd never heard that before, and you're talking about 1,800 miles. So my question when I heard that was, all right, number one, how did the Mayans know the Hopis were up there, and how did the Hopis know the Mayans were down there? And then if you're talking 1,800 miles on foot, I mean, you really, really
right.
want to trade with somebody badly. You know what I mean?
That's right. They didn't have any vehicles. I mean, they could have gone by water, but there's no – it's landlocked. The
right.
Hopi area was in the Southwest Desert, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how true that is. And if it is true, I mean, like I said, you really have to want to trade something.
Yeah, you just pretty much refuted that whole concept of any contact between the Mayans and the Hopis.
Unless they're getting rides. Unless they were getting rides from somebody, who knows. But
no, they both had the same idea because they both had seen it.
Right. That's what I would say.
The Mayans witnessed this. They are now, I think they're located in what is now Guatemala in Central America. Isn't that correct? And then they've got the Incas in Peru in South America.
Okay.
And then there's the Mexican, the Indians of Mexico. All of these people had legends, and most of them were legends. I don't know if we ever found recorded documents, but I can show you other actual written documents and some of the things that were carved on stone, too, from other civilizations, they all say pretty much the same thing.
Right.
The Mayans and the Mexican Indians talk about inner legends that were handed down about a time when the earth became dark for several days. There was tremendous storms, wind storms, darkness, flooding, torrential rains, and then other times, and when things got very hot, the most severe, devastating conditions imaginable. And of course, only a few of them survived. Some of them went into caves and survived that way. But they all talk about the same situation, and one of the most damaging effects was when the earth stood still and there was darkness for 3 days, three, four
right.
days, because the earth was being interrupted, was being slowed down in its rotation by the gravitational hand at a distance now, gravitational hand of this passing body. And when it came over like the porpoise flying over the top of the sun, it exerted gravitational and electromagnetic forces on Earth, which was unfortunately probably right below it, when Earth was making its annual rotation around the sun.
Right.
So visualize this. The porpoise has, now they visualize this porpoise as having a tail. Okay, we're likening it to Planet X, the porpoise.
Yes.
Its tail is the south magnetic pole. You know, all magnets have a north and a south pole. Each
right.
one has a different opposite pulling direction, a magnetic pulling direction. So the tail of the porpoise is the south pole. The nose of the porpoise would be the north pole of this Planet X, this huge brown dwarf star. But it's highly magnetic. It's like a huge magnet. And its south pole would be very much attracted to any other north pole of another magnet that it happens to encounter, right? Because
yep.
north and south attract, opposites attract, just like men and women
right.
attract. So when the south pole passes over the top of Earth's north pole, the south pole of this porpoise Planet X will be very much attracted to it. And when it goes directly above, well, it's not going to tilt. It's not going to rotate the Earth. It's like a lever or a throttle very much because it's directly above. But as it continues to pass over and beyond the planet Earth, what happens? It's putting a vertical rotation on Earth. It's locked at a distance of 15 million miles, about 15 to 20 million miles, but it's magnetically locked on the south pole of that porpoise. Planet X is locked onto the north pole of planet Earth, and it rotates Earth as if you had a joystick, as if Earth had a joystick at its north pole, and you're pulling it downward. The whole Earth would nod like a man's head, like you would signify yes and no, or you're sleeping in a sitting chair, and all of a sudden you fall asleep, and your head nods downward. When you fall asleep, that's the way planet Earth would nod, and it would slow down in its rotation. But first, it would slow down like a top. In order to get a spinning top to topple over, you first have to cause it to slow down. Then it wobbles as it slows down, and as the wobble becomes more accentuated, it topples vertically. And in the Bible, written 600 years ago, given Isaiah. Said that God told him to write this down around 600 B.C. in Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah of your Bible, chapter 24. God says, I will cause the earth to reel to and fro like a drunkard. Well, that's at the top planet Earth wobbling. And then I will cause it to, now I'm giving you exact Hebrew words which I looked up.
Okay.
King James screwed up the translation. And then I will cause it to nod like a hammock. Nodding is always vertically up and down, not, you know, signifying yes, not horizontally.
Right. Right.
So I will cause it to nod like a hammock. Well, visualize this. You take a model globe of planet Earth, put it into your backyard, into the bed of your backyard hammock. Pull the hammock back and preparing it to swing. What happens as you pull it back? Well, the North Pole, which had been, the North Pole, which had been pointing straight up, now rotates down toward where the equator was, right?
Right.
And the equator rotates likewise toward where the South Pole was. So that's nodding like a hammock. That's exactly what God told Isaiah to write in Hebrew, in Isaiah chapter 24.
Right.
Now, if you go to Isaiah chapter 13, God told Isaiah in chapter 13 to write this: I will cause the earth, and I'm going to give you, again, they screwed up the translation, but the words are close. It's not like I'm making up new words. The words are close, but if you go to the Strong's Concordance, there's a famous book called the Strong's Concordance of the Hebrew language, or the exact book is cool. I have it right here. The Strong's Exhaustive Concordance of the Bible. It gives you the original words from the Hebrew in the Old Testament and the Greek in the New Testament. So if you want to look up a translation to find out if the King James English translator screwed up, you can just look it up, find the exact meaning of the word. And that's how I found the exact meanings of these words. In Isaiah chapter 13, it says, I will shake the heavens. God says, told Isaiah to write down, I will shake the heavens and cause the earth to undulate.
Well, look at
the word undulate.
Yeah, that coincides with Hopi prophecy, because, you know, they said that the earth has been reborn and died, has died and been reborn three times. And this fourth time, they say that we're in the fourth world now, and we'll be entering the fifth world after this event. This time, the destruction of this world will shake to and fro, is the wording that they used. And you know, I was watching an interview with Michio Kakao the other day, and he pretty much coincided with that and said, you know, get ready for some big quakes. And, you know, we look at all the preparation on the New Madrid fault line. We look at the seismic activity around the globe. I know that most of the seismic readers have gone off around the world simultaneously at least twice in the past 2 months.
Say that again now. You mean some big quakes happen simultaneously?
No, it's
on a couple occasions.
You know what? I cannot remember the name of the website. It has, I believe it's seismic activity, and it has, however they're monitoring it all around the world. I'll send you the link to the website, and I'll also send you a link to a video I posted that somebody put up when they were monitoring this website I think it was last week, and showing every single detector of seismic activity going off around the world at the same time. And this brings me actually to another question, which I know now that we have about 20 minutes left on the show, I know this is going to lead us into some extensive conversation. Let's talk piezoelectric effect, bird and fish die-offs.
Yeah, there's in the study of electricity and magnetism, you'll find, you can look this up, do a search on the word piezoelectric. That's P, like the word pie, P-I-E, and then the letter Z-O.
Okay, so I'm saying it wrong.
It's pronounced in Italian, piezo, or some people say piezo. Think of P-I-E, pie, and the letters Z-O, and then the word electric,
okay,
all together in one word. Piezoelectric effect is when two crystals, when a crystal is shocked, there's concussion, acts upon a crystal, the result is that crystal generates a high voltage, electrical voltage, which is an energy field.
Right.
Electrical energy field, that's what voltage is. The principle of a piezoelectric principle is utilized in your gas stove. When you turn on the gas range, you'll hear this click, 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 snap, cracking sound, and it's the spark. Like a spark plug that it is zapping and cracking. You can even see the flash of light from the spark. That's generated by a little hammer that whacks this crystal inside of it and causes a high voltage. And when you have a high voltage generated across a very narrow gap, like a spark plug in your old cars, I guess they use fuel injectors now. They still probably use spark plugs, but I don't know what the old technology was, is a tiny little gap. Everybody's seen that, right?
Yep.
Who's worked on their car or their lawnmower. And they make it a tiny gap. The gap has to be precise because they have a gapping tool that I still have for my lawnmower. It has these various gauges, wire gauges, that tell you how many thousandths of an inch the gap should be. So you would bend this little electrode so that it comes either closer, you know, or further to the other adjoining electrode, so that you got just the right air gap, several thousandths of an inch. If the gap is too big, the spark will not jump across it, because if it gets too far away, that high voltage is not strong enough to jump across that air gap.
Okay.
Likewise, underneath the earth, you have tectonic plates. They are minerals similar to crystals.
Right.
They are the forces rubbing and crunching against one another. When there is seismic activity, the forces are incredibly high. Thousands and thousands of tons of force banging, whacking, rubbing each other. And what is generated is probably voltage in the many, many thousands of range of many thousands of volts. And as a result, you have electrical currents. Whenever you have electrical voltage generated and there is enough conductivity in that circuit between the two voltage polarity terminals, which would be across two tectonic plates meeting one another, they would be likened to the two terminals on your car battery.
Okay.
You have enough voltage generated, say 20, 30,000 volts, you're going to have electrical currents under the ground. And those electrical currents could be instantaneously, like a huge, tremendous current, many thousands of amperes of electrical current, which is, you know, the kind of current that you have in your toaster oven, only times a million.
Right.
They would cause tremendous heating and electrification. And what you have is many underground animals are killed through these electrical, piezoelectric generated voltages and electrical currents.
And birds and fish would be very susceptible to this because they're sensitive to that type of activity.
Yeah, I mean, well, fish, for example, but let's take a look at the animals underground. You have insects, you have frogs.
Mm-hmm.
And now many of them are killed instantly, but the ones that are far enough away that they get zapped. Boy, that hurts. That stings. Do you ever get zapped?
I grew up on a farm with an electric fence. I was distinctly remember riding my bike into it and getting it caught under my fender, holding on to my metal handlebar.
Oh, my goodness. Good thing you didn't get electrocuted.
Oh, just electric fence. So, you know, it just hurt and scared the hell out of you. But.
Right. Well, that's what happens to the underground animals. And now we have photographs. I have a photograph. You can find it. I can email it to you, Darren. This photograph is of people. It's taken from the ground on a street in China right before the big earthquake in 2008.
Yes.
I think it was Sichuan, China. And from the ground, you see millions of frogs, toads, swarming right out of the ground all over the streets. And the people are driving their bicycles on this road, you know, not even worrying about it, not wondering what's all this going on. Well, that was a sign there was going to be an earthquake. It happened a few days in advance. Toads swarming out of the ground.
Right.
That was probably because of the piezoelectric voltage that drove them out of there. So you'll see worms coming out of the ground. You'll see insects, maybe. Another thing,
will it drive the global elite from out of the ground? I'm just kidding.
I hope so.
I hope they get electrocuted on the way out.
You know, that may happen. That very well may. I haven't thought about that, but
I'm just being a wise.
But you know, they have the best geologists money can buy, and they had spent trillions of dollars to find the safest locations. But God says in the Bible, I don't care where you go, I'm going to get you. I'm coming after you, and I'm getting you. You can read that in many places in the Bible.
I hadn't heard of this piezoelectric. How am I saying this right? I'm trying to get Italian here.
Piezoelectric.
Piezoelectric effect. Now, when you sent out that email, I told you when we were speaking that I read that and as a explanation of these bird and animal deaths, and it was the first time I had heard of that, and you know, it seemed as a definitely a respectable theory on what was going on, a whole lot more respectable than fireworks. Or the birds getting scared and flying into buildings, you know, which is really what we were told.
Right. Those are all feeble lies. Unimaginative.
Just ridiculous, and just a really an insult to any thinking person's intelligence, or even half thinking person's intelligence. But then, you know, I'd never heard of that before. And what do you know? A couple days later, I'm watching the History Channel again. As I said, it's very entertaining. And they had they were doing a profile on the huge New Madrid fault line, and when it erupted, I mean, when it shook back in the late 1800s, and they were talking about this piezoelectric effect. And they were saying that people were seeing, eyewitness accounts were seeing flashes of light along the ground shooting up into the air and in all directions from wherever the source was that came out of the ground. And so as soon as, you know, when I saw that after reading your email, I'm like, well, you know, I wish John wasn't right, because that means that tectonic plates are shifting all over the planet.
Yeah, I mean, so they describe this, or did they actually show you?
They actually showed. Well, you know, it was there. You know, they did it with a computer generation and gave you some visuals. You know.
So it was shooting out of the ground,
like
lightning. In other words, lightning going in the opposite direction, going from out of the ground upward.
Up, yes.
And what color was it?
They had it like a bluish white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that means it's very hot. Let's see. Now, there's also auroras, which are, you know, this glowing effect in the sky that happens momentarily as a result of this. I have videotape, and I could find it if I look for it. Going back to early 2009, when the huge Chilean earthquake occurred, one of the biggest in history, 8.2, I think. But then again, it's probably bigger than that.
Which they're expecting that to go off again, actually.
Oh yeah, I believe it. That's very scary, very sobering.
They said
very
that.
Very depressing to think that's going to happen again.
Yeah, I just read an article before I called you, and it was out of the BBC. And it said that they had hoped that that quake back in February had released some of the pressure and the strain, but that they're actually saying just the opposite. In fact, it's building up. It did not release any, and it's still building.
That means those plates are really moving,
right?
Really in motion,
right?
Because you would have thought the first one would relieve the strain.
Now let me ask you this: you mentioned auroras, and we all know in the realm of conspiracy that aurora effects in the sky are associated with HAARP activity. And I'm not saying that it's HAARP and the government doing this, although I would imagine I wouldn't put it past them. But I don't think that they're, you know, operating globally. I believe that they would probably use that in specific instances. So do you think that the whole aurora effect from HAARP is disinfo, or do you believe that's correct also?
No, I agree with you that the government has the power, the technology to use technology that they stole from the great genius Nikola Tesla,
right?
To create these create a huge capacitor, electrical capacitor in the sky between the atmosphere and planet Earth,
right,
and cause electrical discharges and all kinds of electrical phenomena, powerful energy, electrical energy phenomena. And they can indeed create earthquakes. They have that technology. Tesla gave, you know, they took it from Tesla. They actually murdered him, too, because I guess he was going against that. He didn't want his information to be stolen and used by these diabolical men who rule the world. But he was no match for their power. So they have the technology. They have the ability to create earthquakes. The difference is that so does this Planet X. But Planet X has a million times greater capacity to create earthquakes than man has through his HAARP technology. And your point is very important, what you stated, that because we're seeing these phenomena, these scary phenomena all over the world, the fish dying and the birds dying in Italy, in Sweden, in Brazil, in Africa, in China, in the United States, all over the world.
Right.
It's not HAARP. It's not the government doing it.
Right.
I agree with you.
I believe it's more nature based or natural phenomenon, and it, like I'm sure you agree with me that, you know, look, it's much easier if people blame the government for everything that's going on, and there's plenty to blame them for, but you know, if you're talking about an event such as a passing of this brown dwarf, then really all of their efforts, you know, or the great majority of their efforts would go to pretty much keeping people distracted from that, you know, and get us involved in things like what's the name of that Project Blue Beam, you know, things like of that nature, you know, to keep you distracted and say and get mad and blame the government for using HAARP technology. But the real deal is most likely, like you said, a natural event. But I have this question for you, okay? And I'm going to throw myself out there so everybody can laugh if they want. I don't really care. I woke up this morning and my friend had sent me a text message saying, "Look at the moon." He said it's bright red, and this was at 5:30 a.m. this morning. And so I peeked out my window that faces to the west and to look at the moon, and it wasn't there. So I was thinking, well, I wonder where my friend is seeing this.
Now, wait, you looked out your window to the west?
Yeah.
What time was this?
This was about 6 o'clock this morning.
Okay, now, the reason is he must have told you the wrong direction because my bedroom window.
No. He didn't tell me that. That's where I normally look out my window.
Oh.
It's not directly west. I'd say it's it's probably southwest.
My bedroom window faces the east.
Yep.
And in the last few days, That's where the moon has been. I wake up and I see it out there, very strong, very eerie. It's the same color. It appears to be the same color, but it's hard to tell because there's only a sliver of it.
There was. It was a very bright yellow sliver this morning. But my question is...
Right,
now,
that's what I saw, but it was toward the east. And I've seen that for the past several days.
Now, is that... I'm just saying, I know I've looked and seen the moon in the early morning hours out my southwest window because I've watched...
You know, you're right. You're right. In the past, I have seen the same thing. I would wake up, and the reason I know, because my bedroom faces east, but when I go downstairs to the kitchen bay window faces the west. And you're right. Many times I've seen the moon early in the morning when I wake up while it's still dark. I can look out there and see the moon to the west. So now, what's going
on
here?
Now, I'm looking at the moon this morning, and, you know, I'm looking at the sliver, and I'm looking at the horizon, and I can see the red of the sunrise coming up on that horizon, and the moon is right in that. Now,
What do you mean? The moon is right in the same position?
It's where the sunrise is coming up.
Really?
I'm not saying anything crazy. I'm just saying I just noticed this morning that
I didn't see that this morning. I saw the sun come up. I mean, the moon, while it was still dark, come up in the east, and it was higher in the sky by the I went downstairs before the sun even arose. But this moon was getting up higher in the sky as the time wore on. So it was not, the moon was not in the same position as the sun. I have not seen that. It was in a different position, higher up in the sky and a little bit in, you know, maybe the same direction. Could be in the same azimuth if you look out, you know, with a compass. Maybe it was in the same direction, but the moon came up first, and then the sun came up sometime later.
All right. So, you know, hey, maybe I'm just noticing this.
Try it again tonight. I mean, if it's
clear.
Oh,
I'm going to.
If there's no clouds, you'll be able to see it.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, you know, I don't know if I sound ridiculous saying this, and I could care less, but, you know, I know where I've seen the moon set, and it's on the other side of my house. And this morning, now obviously, you know, I'm not saying that the planet is in a whole different position or anything like that. Maybe I haven't noticed, but I know at 6 o'clock this morning, you know, by the time the sun rose, the moon did not travel all the way to the western part, you know, of my house.
It never got that far. Right.
So I don't know why I'm kind of confused about where it is and why it's there right now. I don't know. But I'll check again.
Well,
I'll double check again tomorrow.
Right. It's got everybody thinking, all these phenomena. I'll tell you what I was going to do. I have the 1973, right here at my desk here, I got the 1973 World Almanac. And I have this plan. I was going to put it out to a lot of people like you who follow astronomy and are very interested in Planet X, who would be volunteers. In the World Almanac, it tells you the exact time of sunrise. And, you know, for various, every day of the year, I think it is. And, of course, it depends on where you're at, your position. But I think I remember seeing in this almanac, I have to check it again, it'll tell you, like, if you're in New York City, at that specific point on the planet, New York City, the sun rises at such and such an hour and minute on such and such a day.
Mm-hmm.
So you could look it up each day, and I could post that if I can get my computer and scan in the page from the almanac, say, for tomorrow. Tomorrow is February 1st, right? If
yes.
I were to scan, and I don't have time to do it now, then people could get it, and they could say, oh, okay, here's the sunrise. Now, I would ask a lot of volunteers to check to see if indeed it rises at that point. Excuse me one second, please.
Yes. You know, hey, I don't know. I just it's very strange that just looking out over the horizon, seeing the sun coming up, and then seeing the moon right above the sunrise. To me,
excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, anyway, that's one way we could find out if the Earth is wobbling. If the Earth rises, or the sun rises at a particular time, at the correct time that it was supposed to rise in 1973, according to the 1973 World Almanac, then we'll, and if it doesn't rise at that time, and we see serious deviations from 1973 time, sunrise times, then we know we're in trouble.
Okay.
So that's what we can get a lot of volunteers to do. I've got to start doing it. I try to scan in the page, but I think I have to uninstall my scanner program and reinstall it again. It's not working right. But anyway, we definitely have to look at this. Now, another indication of the Earth in wobbling is the Inuit Indians, the Eskimos, I guess. They're called the Inuit tribe in Alaska.
Yep. Hey, John.
Yeah.
Hey, John, we're now into about a minute left, just to let you know.
Oh, okay. The Inuits are saying that on their horizon, the sun is not rising in the right place. It's they're concerned.
Yeah.
And other people are too.
I heard the reasoning for that is some kind of light refraction or something like that.
That doesn't make sense.
But, you know, I don't really pay attention to
that
when
does not make sense
NASA
all.
Comes out and says anything, really. So.
Sure. And then in Greenland, now, there was another report, too. You can check this out. Greenland, the sun rose, because that's up close to the North Pole, right? And so you don't get many days of sunlight there.
No.
And now the sun came up 2 days early, something like that. This appeared 2 days earlier than it's supposed to. So we're getting reports from all over the world that things are wrong. Something's going on with this Earth. It's probably wobbling. Now, that's the Earth's position. What about the Earth's magnetic field, which is something different? It's the magnetic field that emanates through the poles, through the North Pole and down around the Earth, like the skin of an apple would go around the apple. And then it goes up through the bottom of the apple, which is the South Pole. And that's what the Earth's magnetic field is these lines vertically going all around the world like a bird cage, more or less. That magnetic field is shifting also.
All right, John.
Yeah.
got to wrap it up, my friend. I'm under 10 seconds, so I just want to say thank you very much. You know what? I'm going to have you come back in the next 2 weeks, okay?
Okay, thank you. And would you ask your people to, if they want to contact me, that maybe they can contact you, and then we can, you know, at least get to know some of the people who are interested in this so that maybe we could all work together.
Yeah.
Try to help each other out.
Yeah, well, just so you know. Hey, we just went off the air, so.
Okay.
It's but I did that. When I posted up the info about tonight's show, I put your link up there for people and your info.
You can actually field questions and then take the email addresses from these people, and we can have an organization, a group, all working together.
Okay. All right.
Because the Earth is where the whole human race is about to become mostly extinct.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, we can't even imagine, we can't even grasp the seriousness of that. And the more people we have working together, the better off we are.
Yep, I agree.
We should start really joining hands. And you're in a position where you can do that. We can bring people together through your radio program.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm hitting about, you know, 2,000 people a month with this program. I mean, I listened to some of your archives. I mean, you're on shows that hit a lot more people than this one. But, you know, hey, all working together, like I've said, you know, would be, you know, most beneficial. So, you know, I'd definitely love to have you come back on pretty soon and get into some more specific. You know, I didn't even ask you the question. What do you think personally? How close do you think it is?
Well, I have a feeling. I'll tell you what. You know, I'm pretty fortunate because I'm about the only person who's been documenting the Weather Channel severe weather reports ever since. And I think I told you about this, right?
Yes. I tell
everybody this.
Yep.
Because this is a major factor.
Yep.
That since 2004, I've been documenting nothing but severe weather reports on videotape. I have probably about 56-hour videotapes of nothing but Weather Channel severe weather reports. As a result, I've gotten to know what the jet stream looks like. It's extremely abnormal, like a W, and I think I told you that too.
Yep.
A W, which is vertically, you know, the map of the United States.
Yep.
In height. Now that W is, I mean, even the W was extremely bizarre and worrisome because the jet stream should not look like a W. It should look like basically like the North Canadian U.S. border, and I think I mentioned that too. I told my brother about the W shape. He said, well, that's the normal for the jet stream. I said, it's because it's been so abnormal for so long that you think the W is normal. I said, oh, man, I felt like slapping myself in the head. They think the W is normal because it's been like that for 6 years.
Man, I know.
Like a person has been crazy all their life, so, hey, that's normal to be crazy.
I know, and you just touched on a point, the whole short-term memory. I mean, you know, and I use that analogy with chemtrails. I'm like, you know, I've stood there and pointed to people as a plane is putting one down, and there's a regular contrail being put down right near it. And I'm like, do you see the difference? You know, I mean, you're 30 years old. That wasn't like that when you were 10. You never saw that in the air. And they're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Because if that was normal contrailing, we would see that throughout the history of aviation in photographs. It would be, you know, in there somewhere.
That's right. And I remember the old contrails. Yeah, they would disappear real fast.
Right. Right.
And also, that plane had to be really high up in order to create a contrail in the first place.
Exactly.
Because it's cold up there. And
yep.
You never saw contrails coming from lower flying aircraft. So these people are idiots.
No.
We're dealing with a race of morons that have been dumbed down.
It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, John. I swear to God, there's people.
You saw that movie?
Yeah. It's some people, I don't even know what earth they're on. I don't.
I know. It's frustrating.
Man, I'll tell you, there's so much we didn't cover tonight that I wanted to get into.
I know, but yeah, it's okay. We can talk about it. You know what? I'll tell you what. Iron sharpens iron. We can talk about these things on the side from time to time, maybe not every night because you're busy and I'm busy, but we can talk about them over the phone privately. And boy, the more we talk, the more we learn, and the more we trade information. We remember having talked about a particular subject like what we talked about tonight. So that comes back again, and we get even sharper and more detailed and more insightful about everything we're saying. Yeah, you're right. That's how we do it. I do that with Sheldon a lot. He likes to talk, so he helps me to refresh myself on a lot of these things. There's so much. There's a whole body of knowledge, and you need a four-year college degree, at least a four-year college degree, to learn, to get a degree in Planet X. That's how complex and deep this subject is. I wanted to go through the I've got it right in front of me, the Washington Post landmark article, December 30th, 1983, front page.
Yeah.
I wanted to read that just to show the credibility of it. I won't read it now, but it's titled,
right.
Possibly As Large as Jupiter, Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered, by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer. A heavenly body possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical. Well, then on and on. So that I've read that to them, and then I could have said, well, how did they know that this body is Planet X? Maybe it's some other body. Then I would say, okay, let's go back, rewind to exactly 11 months earlier, New York Times, and I got that article right in front of me, the actual article, where they say, we are sending up this infrared astronomical satellite that I just mentioned in the December 30th Washington Post, which discovered this huge Jupiterian body. Well, they're sending up this infrared astronomical satellite specifically to search for Planet X. Therefore, Planet X is the body that was discovered. There's your proof right there. You tie in the January 30th, 1983 New York Times Planet X launch infrared astronomical satellite article to the December 30th of that same year article, Washington Post. You tie them both together and you find out that that huge body that they actually discovered, possibly as large as Jupiter, is the Planet X that they were searching for. There you go.
Proof. Yep.
But you need both halves of the puzzle.
You know,
locked in Washington Post and the New York Times, and you got it nailed down.
Next time you come on, let's do it a little different. Let's do it like, let's just talk about it. Instead of what we got into a lot of today, especially in the first 45 minutes, was basically kind of breaking down and explaining Planet X. I don't want to do that next time. You know, I would rather I'd rather talk about it like, without an explanation of really, what it is. Basically, what it is will come out in what we talk about. But instead of using these analogies to try to explain it to people, let's just talk about it as like you and I would, meaning you're not going to explain to me how it works anymore. We're going to get into more detailed stuff.
Yeah, but Darren, you know how it works. That's why you don't need that. But there's a lot of people.
Well, no. What I'm saying is we'll get the people to ask the questions about it.
I wonder if they will, though. See, a lot of them will think, okay, I got to take this guy's word for it that this thing is coming in. Why would this thing come in?
What
an uneducated person would say, why would it come in? I mean, come on now. You're making this up. I tell them, no, this is one of the first things I need to tell people. Like, it's like the root of the tree. I say, it's a no-brainer. This thing has got to be coming in. It has to be by the laws of physics. It is just as obvious and inevitable as if I were to hold a rock in my hand, outstretched arm, and then release that rock. What is going to happen? It's inevitable that rock is going to be pulled to the ground.
Right.
Likewise, it is inevitable. You take a body that big and place it outside our solar system where it was actually discovered. It has to come in. It's not like, its chances are one in a million it'll pass by, it'll come in toward the sun. No, it has to. Just like that rock. If I drop the rock, you say, the chances are one in a million that it'll fall to the ground. The rock might fly up in the air. It might go horizontally. It might do a few loop-de-loops and then just go out into the sky and disappear forever. No.
No.
That rock has to come toward the ground. Likewise, this thing, Planet X, has to, by the universal law of gravitation, be sucked into the sun. It is being sucked into the sun like a magnet. That is so important to establish that right off the bat. Then they'll understand, yeah, there ain't no two ways about it.
Yeah. Well, see, we can explain it that quickly instead. You know what I mean? I just want to get into some more
Sure, we could do that without talking about the position of the ecliptic and how it comes in from below.
Yeah,
the ecliptic.
Yeah. I mean, we can refer people to you know, information that you have or something like that, that they can go look at that diagram, which actually would explain it to them even better. I actually drew out the diagram.
The diagram from the New Science and Invention Encyclopedia.
I drew it out two times today at work for people.
But you need a three-dimensional thing, though, because it's, you know, it's coming in. The ecliptic is like a flat two-dimensional disk.
Well, you know what was strange?
That's why I use the analogy of the porpoise. That's a three-dimensional visualization right there.
Yeah, no, that's a good visualization for sure.
Why, I mean, you make it so, like, if you drew that picture, like, I took not too much time to explain to draw that picture, but I bet everybody made a visualization in their mind of this big lake, you know, and this porpoise coming up through the lake. I mean, I think that's very graphic.
It was.
They're always going to remember that when they think of Planet X.
Yeah, and when you were
exactly
describing that,
happening.
When you were describing that, the people in chat were saying that they appreciate the visualization. So they were happy with that.
Good. That is so important. You know, I used to teach, I'm drinking some coffee here.
Sorry.
I used to teach high school physics, 12th graders.
Right.
And I always realized I wanted to make things as so vivid for them. And I always realized the importance of drawing these, forcing them, enticing them to create these mental pictures. The more vivid, the better. You know, and something like that they can relate to, a big lake, because everybody has been on a big lake before. I even picture a big lake somewhere, you know, that I have seen once before.
Yeah.
That analogy. So,
oh, that I did too. When you were talking about it, I pictured Lake Nineveh up in Vermont where I spent my summers.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
And if they haven't seen one, they've seen one on television. So everybody's seen one way or another.
Right.
And that's why it's so important, because once they see it, you know what happens? It becomes a part of them. They actually believe it. They say, oh, yeah, I saw that in my mind. This thing is coming in. Why? Because they have now adopted something to be a part of their own mental memory bank. This picture of represents Planet X. Oh, yeah, now I understand it. I've had kids in my class say, you know, I never understood it until you described it that way. A certain concept, you know, I was teaching. I never understood it until you made me draw that mental picture of it. And
wow.
It's just such a wonderful breakthrough.
Well, being a teacher, you've had a little practice of doing that, so that's probably why you explain this so well, you know?
Yeah, I try to, because, you know, the world is, as I say, I can't help but overemphasize that this world is headed for extinction. You know, most of everybody in this planet will be killed in a horrible way in a very short time. So
yeah,
we've got to do everything we can to make people believe. Believe, faith. Faith is the most important thing. Once we get them to the belief about Planet X, we can get them to believe that God promises. He loves us. He promises to protect us. That's why I have no fear.
Yeah.
As long as I keep God in my presence, I visualize, I know that he's with me. He's invisible.
Yeah, and that's kind of that really goes along with in the Hopi prophecy. You know, they basically say that those who live like my people in the land of my people will be saved.
That's wonderful.
So
yeah.
You know, I look to that as, you know, being a more earthbound, you know, type person, and not getting, you know, one of the things I think the New World Order really tries to do is detach us from nature as much as possible. You know, to our, and from our true history also. So, and I think the Hopis were obviously very, you know, bound to the earth and in sync with it. And so it makes sense to me. And, you know, any type of, spiritual awareness I don't even know how to describe it.
It comes from nature. You're right. The Native Americans were close to nature. And you know what? When you get close to nature, you get closer to God.
Right.
The creator, that great spirit.
Exactly.
They used to call, they would call him the spirit, the great spirit. And they would also talk about evil spirits, plural. Evil spirits. They knew about the existence of these invisible, the invisible God, the creator and controller of all things.
Right.
Who was love. They knew that he was love. And
mm-hmm.
they also knew about the existence of these minor spirits, these evil spirits. They were so spiritually astute. It was just amazing. And because they're close to the ground, close to the earth, you can see God's creation around you. And that connects you to God himself. When you're in a glass and concrete and steel building, surrounded by synthetic walls and TV and computer monitors, no sunlight, you got fluorescent lights flickering above you, you're far, far from that creation, the spirit of God. But you can still see God will be with you at all times, but closer to the people who are close to the earth, which were the Native Americans. Spiritually, they were far superior to the white man. The white man came in to kill and destroy like demons, like the devils.
Right. Right. Well, you know, a couple things. Number one, I'm going to get going because I'm starving. I want to eat something.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, be sorry. No, I've totally enjoyed it. It's been great. The other thing is I miss Sheldon's show. I wish he didn't stop doing his show.
There was, you know, he didn't have the disposition for it. The right, the mental disposition. To deal with it. He couldn't solve the technical problems. He was always creating technical problems.
Yes, I know. I know how it went. I'm just saying. It was my Sunday morning thing. I'd always listen to the,
really?
The thing.
Oh.
Yeah. But
He we could have other shows. Jim Berryman would love to have another host on his show.
Well,
Have you checked with Jim Berryman yet?
I never heard of him.
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell you. He's the guy that Sheldon was with. And it didn't work out. I mean, Jim wanted somebody. In fact, I think Jim is looking for more people. My program, Planet X and Bible Prophecy, have you ever heard it? It's a drama. I don't do much talking. I leave the talking and the music. I put music in the background and make it very dramatic.
No, because it's on a Sunday evening, really, that's just a time where I'm pretty much relaxing before I have to take off on Monday morning. I never remember to listen to your show. I never have.
Well, are you available 9 p.m. Eastern?
Well, no, I listened to some of the archives on Sheldon's page.
Okay, and they're all basically musical, you know,
yeah.
Music background. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, Jim, Sheldon said, why don't you go with Jim? And I contacted Jim, and he said, yeah, he's looking for more people. Now, I voluntarily pay him, so I don't have to have commercials. I know he might do it for free, but then he'd have to interrupt with commercials. So I pay him $90. I don't tell my wife that because she doesn't want me spending all that money. But I pay him $90 a month. So it's, you know, he needs the money. He's doing a lot of work to bring this thing up.
Yeah, he is. I met him. I went out to New York and met Jimmy. And
did.
Yeah, I met Jim and I met Sean when he was here from Australia.
Wow, I'll be darned.
Well, you guys are going to be out there. I'm like, you know, if you're gonna be that close, you know, I'll take a ride out. We met in I can't remember where we met. Not Albany. I can't remember where it was.
Jim lives in Tonawanda.
Yeah.
That's not too far from Massachusetts, right? Because that's in Western Mass, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's not too far from the New York border. Albany, I guess.
Right, right, right. But, you know, Jimmy was a real nice guy. So was Sean. I'm just kind of disappointed in the way the whole Sheldon thing went down, really, you know.
Well, it's okay, you know, because, have you considered... I don't know if you would switch. If you switched, then you might lose a lot of listeners. But then again, you could take them with you.
From where?
From where? I mean, whatever listeners you have.
Well, I do a show on Jimmy's network, too, on Saturdays at 2.
Oh, you are? On Micro 1650 AM.
Yeah, Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I don't have a big following there. But what are you talking about, switching to go where?
Well, that's what I meant. I didn't know you were with Jimmy already. I was going to say, why don't you go with Jim Berryman on Micro 1650 AM?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's when I said I didn't hear Jim Berryman, I wasn't thinking. I didn't even know his last name.
Okay.
Yeah, I know Jimmy pretty well. Yeah, I I'm already there. You know, to be honest, John, I do three shows a week, and
that's rough.
I'm pretty
shocked.
And
then you got a job. You got two jobs, right?
One. I have one. But it's I've actually thought about stopping doing the Saturday show on Jimmy's network because it's only an hour. And, you know, like I said, it's my third show of the week by that time. And I'm just, I just can't even really, I need a big break on Sunday. I don't look at news. I don't listen to news. I don't do any of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's good that you're doing what you are, what you're capable of doing. You're doing quite a bit. And, the world, you're doing what God is calling you to do. It's so important. And, sure, you know your limits.
Yeah.
And we all have, I could never do a show myself. I mean, I do one a week. You know why? Because it's all on CD.
Right.
I don't have to get up there and call in and start talking to people. I just say, play that CD. Play CD number one or number two or whatever.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's cool.
You can do the same thing, actually. I don't know. No, you can't because you have a talk show.
Yeah, no, you know, I love doing my blog. The show you're on tonight, the Blog Talk Radio, I love doing it. There's no FCC regulations. I have no commercials, you know, and I really just, it's my deal, and I'm in total control of it, and I like that. It's the dictator in me, John, you know, total control over my shit. No,
but you're
kidding.
You're a great host. You're very easygoing. You allow people to talk. Some people are jumping in there all the time. I hate going on Deagle's show.
Yeah.
Deagle?
Yes.
Oh, I hate going on there. I hate to say no because I don't want to antagonize him. Fortunately, he hasn't asked me yet. He's busy having John Moore on all the time and Ann Morrison. But he does all the talking. He won't let, you know, he's like, I'm like his echo chamber.
John, it's going to hit us. Going to hit us hard more.
is that what he says?
He always says every show. It's going to hit us. Going to hit us hard. Yeah. So I've had him on the show. I've had Lucas on the show. I've had Catherine Albrecht on the show for RFID technology, and I had Sheldon on the show. So those are the guests that I've had on the program. Most of my guests have been Planet Xers. I'll tell you something though. I don't trust Lucas at all. I just don't trust that guy. And
Sheldon's been telling me a lot of stuff. Lucas said this or Lucas said that, and I say, well, some of it's right, but I don't believe some of these other things that he's saying. Some of it, I say, it's not right. What he's saying is not right.
Yeah, I don't trust him, and I'll tell you, the main reason I don't trust that guy is when he talks about chemtrailing, and he says that, oh no, you know, come on now, the government's not trying to hurt everybody, and
he says that.
Yeah,
he said, I thought he was just the opposite. I thought he was a real, iconoclast.
Well, this is the whole thing. This is where my whole disconnect with him came. It's like you're going to sit. He says that, oh, they're trying to chemtrail and block out the excess radiation from the sun, you know, because of, you know, Planet X coming in.
Oh, I got your point. No, wait a minute. I have to stop you there. Now I understand what he was saying. Actually, I think he's right. I'm trying to be honest. I think he's right about that because I had surmised this about 5 years ago, and I spoke to Joyce Riley on the phone, and she said, what do you think of the cause of the chemtrails? And I said, I suspected, I didn't have any evidence, that they're trying to block out the sun because the sun is going to get really, really hot with all this solar excitation, and they're trying, I mean, they have to do it, not because they're good guys. They're a bunch of diabolical monsters. They're trying to kill, you know, the human race, wipe out most of the human race and leave just a small half a billion person slave force. However, they got to protect themselves, so they've got to stop that solar scorching.
Well, okay.
I have evidence to that effect, too.
But you don't dump. You're not dumping, you know, tons of aluminum on top of people's heads, knowing the deadly effects on the human body with aluminum.
And barium, too. It's very deadly.
Right,
Very deadly. Right. But here's the thing. These people are diabolical monsters. Their concern is only protecting themselves from the solar scorching. To hell with everybody else. In fact, if everybody dies from that aluminum, they're gleeful about it. They're happy.
Sure. So this is what I'm saying. I'm not saying that that couldn't be used to block out excess radiation, but at the same token, like most of their schemes and plans, they're multifaceted. They have other
exactly.
layers to them. So, you know,
exactly.
intelligent
they are, and that's how complex. They have the best brains working with them. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I mean, so for Lucas to say they're not trying to hurt you, and this is a guy that did a film about 9/11 being an inside job. You know, you're not explaining yourself very well.
Lucas doesn't have the knowledge about what the real purpose. He knows one half of the truth is that the primary reason that they do have the chemtrails is to block out the solar radiation, but a secondary purpose is to exterminate much of the population too. Although that's not going to really be the major factor in extermination. They're using other techniques too.
Hey, for the time being, it makes people sick. It feeds the system, and you know whatever
yeah.
keeps the cronies, you know, doing their work and making the money.
But yes. Well, Lucas is right though. I mean, he just doesn't have the insight to know that they're doing it for other purposes. But he's basically right. The main reason I believe now, I'm not perfect, but I believe that the main reason they're having the chemtrails is to create this polymer balloon around the Earth comprised of a polymer with particles, reflective particles embedded in it, so it becomes more or less like an aluminum balloon. Now that's very reflective. They need something like that to keep that heat, solar scorching out. At the same time, look at their cover story. They're saying we have a global warming. They've been able to get by on that lie for a long time.
Right.
Because they knew the Earth was warming up from the sun, so they have to blame it on something terrestrial in the Earth, the terrestrial cause for the globe to warm up. We know it's from the sun. They know it's from the sun, but they have to lie and say it's coming from in the Earth itself, from us, greenhouse gases. So let's see now. They create this polymer bubble with aluminum embedded in it, and that makes a wonderful umbrella, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jerry E. Smith was a science researcher about the New World Order on a scientific basis.
Mm-hmm.
He was murdered. I know he was murdered.
Yeah.
That was
this past summer, right? Was he the guy in the hot tub?
No, that was Matthew Simmons.
Simmons, that's right.
Right, but
that was
Jerry Smith died around the same time, actually, you know, and Sheldon and I were talking about this. 1 month before the start of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, Jerry E. Smith died. I think he was murdered because I think he knew what they were doing. And for some reason, he was trying to bring out the information. That's probably why they killed him. But when Jerry E. Smith and Sheldon tried to find the archive that I referred him to, he was on the Joyce Riley Power Hour. I'm estimating somewhere around the year 2005 to 2007, somewhere around there. He was on there. We could look at Joyce Riley's archives. And Sheldon said he couldn't find it, but Jerry E. Smith was on there, and I remember specifically he was saying that the chemtrails are creating a polymer with aluminum and barium, and there's a polymer is sort of like a plastic, you know,
right.
material that forms like sort of like a bubblegum bubble
yep.
surrounding the Earth. And I'm not sure if he actually knew that it was to block out the sun's rays, but he definitely said that. And I said, well, that makes all the sense in the world, because I knew the solar scorching was going to hit.
Yes.
And they've been doing that ever
since
1996 with the chemtrails. So think about it. In 1996, they knew Planet X was coming in. They said, let's put chemtrails in the fuel of all the planes. That's the only way we can get enough of this stuff in the atmosphere. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say that's another thing we didn't touch on tonight is the solar scorching, and I started leading us that way, and then I went somewhere else.
Well, it's okay. There's just so many places to go. It's hard to, you know,
yeah.
follow all the avenues at the same time. So anyway, there you go. There's evidence from Jerry E. Smith, murdered, and he's I believe he's right now. Here's some more evidence. there was a guy who came on, Michael Murphy, I think it was Michael Murphy, yeah. Remember the name. And then look it up on Joyce Riley's Power Hour website, thepowerhour.com.
Yep.
Click on guests, click on alphabetical order, click on Michael Murphy. He's the one who came on and said, I know what the New World Order has been doing. Guess what? I was at a meeting with these high-level military intelligence guys, and they said the chemtrails are for the purpose of blocking out the sun.
His name was Michael
Murphy.
And he went
on to say, Michael Murphy, M-U-R-P-H-Y, I believe.
Yep.
And it was the same show as G. Edward Griffin. So look for that day when they came on together. G.
Okay.
Edward Griffin also. And Michael Murphy said, they're lying. There you go. I caught them lying because this high-level military officer told me at there was a secret meeting. He told me he was at a secret meeting. Nobody was supposed to know about it. But he said, we are definitely doing the contrails. We're the ones deliberately doing it. And we're doing it to block out the sun's rays. And this guy, Michael Murphy, took it as another New World Order lie to try to cover up the real reason. Michael Murphy, just like Luke, like somebody else might say, oh, they're trying to kill us with the chemtrails. That's why they're putting up the chemtrails. They're trying to kill us. That's what Murphy thought.
Well,
he said, this whole idea about blocking the sun is a cover story. It's a lie. When, in fact, I know just the opposite, that the blocking of the sun is the primary purpose for doing it. So there's more evidence. Michael Murphy got the evidence from a high-level military official who was at a secret meeting. The guy, Michael Murphy, misinterpreted the whole statement. He took the truth to be a lie, because we always take something that comes out of the mouth of the New World Order to be a lie.
Well, I never, let me put it this way, I didn't dispute the fact that it could be being used as a shield also, but my big hang up with what Lucas said is that, oh, they're not trying to hurt us.
Okay. Well, the hurting is a secondary thing. It might not even be part of their intention at all. I'm not sure. I really can't. I can't say one way or the other. I have to be honest. But I am quite sure. I can never be 100% on anything. So
right.
I don't want to. You know, I want to be as honest as I can. I'm quite sure, almost completely sure, that the purpose, possibly the one and only real purpose, by far the primary purpose, is to block out the sun. And if any damage comes to the people as a result of it, then that's icing on the cake for them. But that the whole cake itself is block out that solar energy, because we're going to get blasted really
sure.
bad. And you go to Jesse Ventura's Apocalypse 2012, you see how serious this thing is.
Oh, yeah.
They're going underground because of the solar scorching.
Yeah. You know what else we didn't? We didn't get into the Gulf Stream stopping. We didn't get into any of that. Damn.
And the coldest winter that Europe has ever seen.
Yes, well, you know, let's see how long winter lasts into summer over there, and then we'll get a better idea.
Wow, I'll tell you, it's amazing what the great Indian prophet No Eyes. Did you ever hear of No Eyes?
I might have. I don't.
Look up. You might be able to just jot this down and look up Mary Summer Rain, Mary Summer Rain, and No Eyes. Do a Google search on that. And No Eyes said, I mean, this was years ago, to Mary Summer Rain, she said, great storms will come. They'll cover all towns. Summer and winter all mixed up.
And so what do we have?
Now, how did she know
wheat,
that?
Right?
You're far away.
If
you're eating, please continue to eat. I don't mind.
Oh, no, I'm not eating. I have to go downstairs and eat. But I was going to say, and what are we seeing for this predicted snowstorm starting tomorrow? 100 million people affected, you know, a third of the population of the country.
Darren, it's getting bad. I looked at that jet stream on the Weather Channel, and I'm used to seeing a whacked-out jet stream. I got scared. The trough of this W, which used to encompass... used to have the height of the United States of America. That's what its height was. And its width was about one-half the United States, one-half the width of the United States of America. That W is now, the top of the peak of the W comes all the way from near the North Pole. The left-hand V of the W, a W is two Vs side by side, right? The left-hand V... starts from the North Pole, comes all the way down into Mexico.
Wow, right covers now you're talking
about? Now, this morning on the Weather Channel, this morning. And it's been like that. I mean, it's getting like that progressively worse every day. The W is getting bigger and bigger.
Hey,
the left-hand V on the W goes all the way down to Mexico. And guess how wide? Just the left-hand V, not the double V of the W. Or I should say the W. It's a double U. The left-hand U of the W covers the entire United States from California to New York.
All right, hold on. Give me 1 second. I'll be right
That's
back.
That's all frigid air. That's all frozen air from Canada.
Hey, give me
the
one
entire
second.
United States has got Canadian air.
All right, hold on. Give me 1 second. I'll be right back.
Okay. Darren, I got to let you go eat supper.
Oh, okay. I had to
eat supper real bad. You've been very polite. I got to let you go eat supper.
Oh, hey, listen, John, I'm not being polite. I'm enjoying the conversation.
I am too, but I feel bad. I mean, you've got physically, I don't want you to go under any more deprivation than you have already.
No, I'm good. I mean, if you have a couple more minutes, I really want to hear about the big W we have going on here.
Well, that U, that left-hand U covers the entire United States, even into Mexico,
so
with nothing but frigid Arctic air.
So this
the
is
entire,
be
I mean... Pardon me?
It's going to be a bad storm.
It's going to be possibly the worst in history. I mean, I don't know how much precipitation there's going to be. Now, I'm just talking cold air.
Right.
It could be, hopefully, just cold, dry air and no snow. But just in terms of temperatures, this is going to be the coldest overall United States. If you average that, every single temperature in all the major cities of the U.S., Miami, Houston, Los Angeles, Dallas, Denver, et cetera, Chicago, and average them all out, this will be the coldest average United States temperature in recorded history.
Okay, stop right there. Look, I just logged on to the Weather Channel website. You know what it says? As you're saying that right now, it says, damn it, the thing switched. Oh, here it goes. Ice, tornadoes, snow, all on the table. Then the next thing, why this storm could be historic.
Wow. Yeah, it's scary. I'm scared. And listen, Darren, you've got to get your car. You've got to talk to your people. People are going to die in their cars. I'm going to tell my son. I got to get his car set up with emergency stuff. We got to talk about this next. When you go eat, after you go eat, maybe tomorrow or the next day, when you're refreshed, we've got to talk about what to put in our cars to save our lives. People are going to die, are going to be frozen solid in their cars. They're going to get corpses out of cars all over the country.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be snowed in. I got stuck on a highway one time coming back from Bell Laboratories where I worked.
Yeah.
Because of the ice, the cars were sliding sideways off the road. That's how bad it was. Gridlock. It was cold. I slept in my car. It's a good thing I had my sleeping bag. People are going to be, there's going to be frozen corpses snowed in all over the country.
Do you have a website, a good website to reference the jet stream currently?
No, I don't. The Weather Channel wouldn't show it probably because they just have the big headlines and the film footage. But just remember the word weather map, okay? Now, or National Weather Service, NWS National Weather Service, weather maps. You can Google that.
No,
and
right.
The weather maps are what they call these things that we're talking about, the maps of the U.S. with the jet stream on it.
You are right. I'm looking at a jet stream that says it's valid through tomorrow, and it is. You're right. There is just one side. It's a big U.
Yes.
Big U. And
I mean, wow, it's scary. This is really scary. You should, everybody stay in your house. Don't go out. And not only that, you got to have survival stuff in your house. People are going to lose power. I saw on the Weather Channel a tree come crashing down, pull the power lines right straight down to the ground.
Yeah.
People are going to need power. Now, just think of your furnace. You need a little bit of electricity. I've got an inverter. We should go out to Costco or whatever, these big discount places, wherever you get these batteries, deep cycle marine batteries. They're more powerful than car batteries. The good thing is they can go into deep discharge without being damaged. That you hook them up to an inverter. I've got about 7 of them, but they're old. They're mostly from Y2K. I don't know how good they're going to be anymore. There's a way to rejuvenate them, but they can only last so long. I better get new ones. The thing is, that inverter is 12-volt batteries, marine batteries, and the inverter takes it and converts it to alternating current, 120 volts. But only just enough. I want to dedicate it only to my furnace, powering my furnace. So I can, when my power fails, I can plug in my furnace to that inverter and still have enough AC power to run what? The essential electrical stuff, which would be the relay, the electrical relay, and the electrical pump, which pumps the hot water through your radiators.
Well, I'm going to be a little more archaic than that. I have a wood stove that pretty much kicks ass. I haven't even turned my furnace, my oil heat on yet this year.
Well, you're doing the right thing. You're doing a great thing. This is life-saving.
And I am well stocked up on a year's plus supply of stored food.
That's wonderful. Darren, that's what we should be talking about. Because as we're convincing people about Planet X and they're freezing to death in their homes,
right,
it does no good. We better start talking survival.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, John, I'm not a big survivalist guy, meaning I don't have a lot of survival knowledge, or else this, my show, would be all about that. I wouldn't even bother touching on any political garbage or New World Order garbage, any of that stuff.
Well, everybody and their mother's already covering the New World Order, so
exactly.
We don't need to.
Exactly, but my knowledge base on survival tactics is not that great. Now,
oh, you don't need a lot, Darren. It's all simple. Like you say, I got sardines, the two fish that start with SA, wonderful, highly nutrient-dense sardines, but they have to be from Canada, not from polluted Poland,
right,
or Morocco. Brunswick brand. My wife's always yelling at me for buying so much. I'm going to go out and buy some more. I got boxes of them in the basement. Brunswick sardines and then the canned salmon. This all comes from the northern waters of Canada and Alaska. You can survive on that. The bags of dry split peas, dry bags of dry barley, very cheap. Now, I mean, I got them for 79 cents a bag. Split peas, barley, and lentils. Those three dry products.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you got lots of that stuff. I got all that, and plus the sardines and salmon.
Yeah.
Then water. Now, number one, I've been saving all the bottles from my niece and other people, saving all these empty half-gallon juice bottles, half-gallon soda bottles, and gallon milk bottles, and just rinsing them out. I've got water that's like 6 years old in these bottles.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
have you treated
6 years
it
ago, I filled them up, and they're still there.
Have you treated it at all? Is there some?
No,
some
I haven't.
Right?
I haven't, but I've got a Berkey, travel Berkey filter.
Oh,
and then I've got lots of disinfectants. I've got silver germicides that I could put in the water. So I got no problem there. First I pour it through the Berkey filter. And after all, you could drink that water right out of the bottle. You won't die from it, but you'll die if you don't drink it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's a gaping hole in my preparedness thing, John. I don't have actual stored water. I have many ways to filter and to purify, but I don't have...
You got to get that water. Get as many. Start going right now. Go to the recycling places. I told this to Sheldon. He started doing it.
I have about 8 gallons. I should say that. I have about 8 gallons, but that's nothing.
That's nothing. You need 800 gallons.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating, but you figure one family is going to use about 2-3 gallons a day. So how many days is that going to last you?
Right.
I mean, you might get by in 1 gallon a day if it's just you and your wife.
Yep. That's all.
Say a gallon and a half a day. So, anyway, go to recycling places. Next chance you get, call them up first. Find out where they are. Say, look, can I get some bottles? I mean, what would it cost me, or can I get them for free? Empty half gallon soda bottles, gallon water bottles, you know, whatever. How many can I get?
Right.
And just keep on loading up your car. And just start filling up tap water, cold tap water. Then you take your empty boxes. My wife is always yelling at me because I keep every cardboard box I ever got. I got stacks and stacks of cardboard boxes, but they come in handy for storing the canned sardines and salmon and the grains and beans, the barley, lentils, split peas, and boxes for the water, different size water bottles. I even keep the ketchup bottles, rinse them out and use them for water. You know, peroxide bottles, 1-quart peroxide bottles, rinse them out, put the, I put water in them too.
Okay.
I mean, you can't live very long without water. 1 or 2 days and you're dead. Call the recycling places and get as many as you can and start telling your listeners to do the same thing. All these things. This is simple. You don't have to be, this ace survivalist like some of these people, present themselves as wonderful survivalists. You don't need all that knowledge. You need water. You need food.
Right.
You need germicides to kill the germs, period.
Yep.
So
yep. I have a couple bottles of silver. I have some herbal immune boosters.
I got several germicides because I don't know how well each works. So I got the super silver, but then I also got the mild silver protein. Super silver is 10 parts per million, but the molecule is supposed to be pretty effective. Then I got the 400 parts per million mild silver protein from Bill McFarland. So I got both, and I mix them together more or less in the water. But anyway, hey, I better let you get going. But it's important because what we just talked about is more important than anything else because it's a matter of life and death.
And it's immediate.
So we'll talk more about, I'm sorry, what?
As I said, and it's immediate.
Immediate, right. Food, sardines, water, etc. Food, water, germicide. Silver germicides, and then you're set.
Hey, after we go, if you're not doing anything, check out the Weather Channel website for this what they're saying about this storm.
Wow, I'm going to be watching the Weather Channel. I spend a lot of time watching it, so okay. I'll check it out tonight on TV.
The words they're using are historic, record-breaking, crippling, and paralyzing.
Darren, a lot of people are going to die very soon from this storm. I'm afraid we're going to be taking frozen corpses out of cars all over the country, all over Europe, as a matter of fact.
Oh, my God. Those people are not set up for cold weather.
They're not prepared at all.
Their homes, their water pipes are on the outside of their houses, most of them.
Oh, my goodness.
In the
That's
UK.
It.
I
mean, they're in trouble.
Their frost line is like a foot or something like that. I mean, they're not prepared at all.
Oh, that's hard. That's rough. And same thing in Washington State. Washington State is up there, but they usually get warm winters.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, all we can do is advise, have more, we're going to increase our love for others, try to help them as much as we possibly can with the knowledge to get them motivated. So that's, thank goodness you got your radio show to help to save lives. We'll talk more about it.
I hope so. All right, John. Well, good luck.
Call me anytime. Call me anytime, and we'll talk about how to stay alive.
All right. Maybe I'll call you tomorrow from the middle of something historic.
And then get on the radio and start talking to other people, too, okay?
Yeah.
Because we got to get together and help each other to save our lives.
I hear you. Hey, man, if we have any type of normalization of weather, if it warms up a little bit, maybe this spring, if you don't mind, I'd like to take a ride down and meet you and go have a cup of coffee or beer. Or
okay, that would be terrific.
Just talk face to face,
Sure.
All right.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot, Darren.
All right, John. Thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling me.
All right.
Bye-bye now.